It's funny, not in a ha-ha kind of way, but in one of those interesting kind of ways, how God pulls together sermons, even from the book of Exodus. I wouldn't normally go to the book of Exodus for Father's Day message, but I hope, that what we have this morning ties in well with what we celebrate even today. We're in Exodus chapter 23. We're going to be looking at verses 20 down through verse 33, end of the chapter. Exodus 23, beginning in verse 20. "Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. Pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. But if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I blot them out, you shall not bow down to their gods nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them, break their pillars in pieces. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from among you. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days, and I will send my terror before you, and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come. I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you, and I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in one year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply against you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and possessed the land. And I will set your border from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, from the wilderness to the Euphrates. For I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them and their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you to sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you." You know, it's significant when we come to this part of the text. None of us really likes the idea of somebody watching us, especially if they're watching us all the time. And yet that's what God is giving to his people here. He says, "I'm going to send my angel before you. He's going to be with you. Wherever you go, he's going to go. Whatever you do, he's going to see." A new book's come out this fall about Christopher Hitchens. It's called The Faith of Christopher Hitchens. Obviously, he's one of they call him the Four Horsemen of the New Atheism. Christopher Hitchens doesn't believe in God and doesn't want to believe in God. But it's interesting why. In an interview toward the end of his life back in 2007, Hitchens says this, "I think it would be rather awful if this whole idea of God was true, if there was in fact a permanent, total, round-the-clock, divine supervision and invigilation of everything you did. You would never have a waking or sleeping moment when you weren't being watched and controlled and supervised by some celestial entity from the moment of your conception to the moment of your death. It would be like living in North Korea." This quote came in our Trinity study. Michael Reeves picks it apart a little bit, and he points out that Hitchens' problem isn't so much with the existence of God as with the character of God. Nobody wants Big Brother breathing down their neck, watching where you shop, what you buy, who you talk to, where you go. None of us like that because none of us like or trust that kind of an entity. But our God is a loving Father who looks over and watches everything we do, and he's the one who's overseeing and supervising everything so that within his household he can provide and meet needs and see to the welfare of those who belong to him. It's very much like the Proverbs 31 woman who before dawn
She's up and tending to the needs of her household. Late at night, her candle is not going out so that she can meet the needs of her household. Christopher Hitchens isn't so much against the idea of the existence of God as he is against the character of a God that he doesn't know, he doesn't trust. I was young. I remember being in the four-year-old Sunday school class. I wasn't concerned so much about this God being such a terrible thing. I learned to love this God. There was a song that we sang when I was in that class. Oh, be careful, little hands, what you do. Be careful, little hands, what you do. For the Father up above is looking down in love. Oh, be careful, little hands, what you, little feet, where you go. Little ears, what you hear. Little eyes, what you... Okay. For the Father up above is looking down in love. The idea of a God looking down in love wasn't a terrifying thing. It was actually a reassuring thing for my little imagination. I didn't get scared out of my pants because of this God who's watching everything I do. Yet the fear of God was very much a part of my young life, knowing that whatever I do, God's watching. Just like whatever I do, my dad's watching. So sometimes you behave not because you want to, but because if you don't, there's going to be consequences. Well, right. But most of the time, you do what you do in light of this loving presence because you understand that there's one who's there to protect you, who knows more than you, who wants your very best. And that's what our God does. And as we come to this stage of the text, we've been at Mount Sinai, where God has brought his people to himself. And as God descends on Mount Sinai, he descends with lightnings and smoke, with thunderings and trumpetings. And it's enough to scare them. In fact, as we come to chapter 20, we see that the people of Israel are, in fact, afraid. As God has given the Ten Commandments, he speaks the 10 words. And they say, Moses, you be the mediator. You be the one that goes up and talks to him. Don't let him talk to us anymore, or what? We're going to die. We're going to perish. And as God concludes the Ten Commandments, there's this utter context of fear. And Moses says, don't be afraid. God came to make you afraid. What? Don't be afraid as in terrified and shaking in your boots. But God is wanting to drive home to you at this point that you can't just march into his presence as you jolly well please. There's certain protocol that are required. Yes, there must be a mediator. There must be an altar. There is a thing called holiness. There are things called sins. These things break fellowship. They break relationship. And so as he begins explaining now, he's cut out the 10 words for them. He's told them what they are. And for the last three chapters, he's applied them to justice. He's applied them to what it looks like in community. He's applied it to ethics. Now he comes down to the end of explaining some of these things and he moves into a different metaphor. The Father up above is looking down in love. Or we could say it this way. God's watchful presence is his fatherly expression of his steadfast love. You know, it's significant to remember that in this passage, it comes at the end of the Book of Covenant, and Kaiser refers to it as the epilogue that concludes the covenant code. One of the writers refers to the fact that there's very poetic language that's used in these 14 verses. Reichen points out the fact that typically an ancient covenant ends with blessings and cursings, describing in careful detail what happens if the covenant is kept or broken. We come to the end of this covenant agreement as God's laid it out and explained for his people, and this book of the covenant is no exception. After telling his people what to do, God tells them what will happen if they do it or if they fail to do it. But it's not just an ordinary king-vassal treaty. God's already told his people, as he's brought them out of Egypt, he's told them what the relationship is, how they stand before him. As his firstborn son, he's set this his divine affection upon these people. As his treasured possession, their welfare is of utmost concern to him. As a kingdom of priests, he's granted them ready access into his presence. As a holy nation, he's set them apart to be successful as they serve him. These are all positive things that God has laid out for them. And so as he comes to the end of this book of the covenant, then they're just about ready to exchange vows, if you will. God with the people with God. But as God has come to them in this tenor and this context of overwhelmingness, he wants to remind them that he's a good God. Yes, he's great and greatly to be feared. If I would run against the grain of the will of my God, but so long as I would humbly cling to him, so long as I would humbly submit to him, I can understand that this God has placed his affection on me, finds pleasure in me, gives access to his very presence, and wants me to succeed as his representative on planet Earth. And that's God's goal for his people. What God proposes at the end of this agreement is meant not to disquiet the collective imagination of his people, but rather to inspire them by letting them know that their life, their choices, matter enough to be inspected and reviewed by a Father who loves them. A Father who, in fact, is for them, not against them. Oftentimes, we as children, and it doesn't matter how old we are as children, when our parents lay down laws, we look at them and we say, "You can't, you can't, you can't. You must, you must, you must." It's like, oh, man. Anytime somebody tells me I can't, or tells me that I must, I want to do what I can't do, and I don't want to do what I have to do, simply because somebody told me I have to do it. But God says, listen, you must, because I love you. You can't, because I love you. You might not understand it all, how it all fits just yet, but at the core, at the bottom, I need you to understand that whether you understand it or not, I love you, and you have to understand that. And that's what he's getting at as he moves us forward this morning. God's watchful presence is the fatherly expression of his steadfast love. In this text this morning, I think we'll see that there's two focal points of God's watchful presence. The first is this: your loving Father intimately watches over your way. Look at verses 20 through 23 once again. 20 through 23. Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. In light of their relationship, God offers his presence. I'm sending an angel before you. Somebody's presence isn't necessarily a scary thing if you know that that person loves you. God comes down, he's on the mount with the smoke, the fire, the thunderings, the lightnings. He's present. Pretty terrifying thing. And God says, guess what? The good news is, I'm going to stay with you. Great. But when somebody loves you, you want them to be with you. And God says, this is good news. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay with you. I'm going to stay with you in the presence of an angel. The word is messenger. When it refers to somebody who's supernatural, it has the idea of an angel, a divine messenger. But as this messenger starts to play out his role, we see that he's more than just a supernatural being. We're going to see that this is a theophany, that God is sending none other than the second person of the Trinity, the angel of the Lord, the pre-incarnate Christ. This messenger will serve not only as a guide in the wilderness, but Alter says he's an unblinking executor of God's divine surveillance, which, again, seems a little creepy if you don't understand his purpose. As you look at this, this angel is meant to guide and to guard. He will guard you on the way, and he will bring you to the place, a place that I have prepared for you. That is, he's acting on behalf of God. He's going to be speaking, verse 21, pay careful attention to him, obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, because my name is in him. Verse 22, if you carefully obey his voice and do all that what? Verse 22, if you carefully obey his voice and do all that... wait a minute, who's talking? The angel or God? Yes, okay. By listening to the angel, I'm listening directly to God. This angel is guiding for God. He's guarding for God. He's speaking on behalf of God. He, in fact, holds the power of forgiveness at the end of verse 21. If you rebel against him, he will withhold pardon from you. Well, who can forgive sins but God? This is none other than God himself. His presence is the equivalence of the presence of God. So in this relationship, he offers his presence. But with regard to the journey, he offers his protection. You see that second line there in verse 20. I'm sending my angel before you, or before your face, in your very presence, to guard you in the way. It's the idea of Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. His rod and his staff, they comfort me. He prepares a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. This angel of God goes with his people to protect his people, to guard his people. The idea of guarding is to set up and keep watch for the sake of protection. So I can go to sleep at night because God's messenger is there keeping watch over me. He says in verse 22, I will be an enemy to your enemies. That is, I will be hostile and actively oppose anybody who actively opposes you. Well, don't you want somebody on your team like that? Don't you want somebody in your corner that's going to actively oppose anybody who actively opposes you? God says, listen, that's what I want to do for you. I want to be on your corner, on your team. I want to be there for you. I will be an adversary to your adversaries. The idea of the word there is to bind, to confine, to restrict. I will hold back and bind up anyone who seeks to restrict and confine you in the way. I'm sending my angel to be in your very presence, to do this for you. So as long as you go down this path, I'm going to be with you. We see that with regard to the destination, he offers his direction. Not only does he guard us in our journey on the way, but he's bringing us to a destination, providing us direction all the way until we get there. You know, I want somebody to go with me who knows the way. I remember the first time I went into New York City. I was leading the way. I was in a 15-passenger van with, I don't know how many, it seemed like 100 junior hires sitting behind me, and a 12-foot trailer, U-Haul trailer, on the back of that van. I went through a tunnel. I got through in the wrong lane. I was supposed to turn right. Three lanes over, I couldn't merge my behemoth of a vehicle, so I just turned left, and I'm going to go around the block. Ha, 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 ha. Yeah, all of a sudden I'm lost in New York City. And I was leading somebody else. Contrast that with the time I went up a couple years ago with a guy who used to drive truck in New York City. We're in just this little car. He's like, chum, 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 chum. Knows right where he's going. Doesn't care if people are honking at him. You know what? I used to back a trailer right into there. Yeah, I used to block traffic across this whole alley. It wasn't much more than an alley, but people going down every 5 seconds. Yep, I used to park there half the night. People would get mad at me. They'd finally go around the block. You know what? I love going to New York City with somebody who knows New York City. God says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to send my messenger to go along with you because he knows the way. And he's going to lead you all the way home. It's the idea at the end of Psalm 23. Surely goodness and mercy will chase me down all the days of my life until I rest in the house of my God forever. He's going to get me there. That's what the shepherd does. God says that's what I want to be for you. With regard to the details, he offers his instruction. You know, it's not really all that hard to follow instruction when you really believe that that person knows more than you and you really believe that that person wants you to succeed. Yeah. I have a hard time listening to instruction if I really don't believe that that person knows what they're talking about. Or if that person has an agenda that really only advances their purposes and doesn't benefit my welfare. I really have a hard time trusting that person. But God says, listen, verse 21, I want you to positively pay careful attention to this one. It's the same word as he wants to guard you above. It's the idea of you guard yourself. You keep watch. You set up watch for your own soul. You pay careful attention because now the responsibility is on you to pay attention to him. He's watching out for you. But keep your eye on this one. The idea of hearing is made the condition of protection. My protection is tied to how well I listen, how well I hear. He says in verse 21, obey his voice. And again, it's the word that means to hear. It's the word shema, but it has the idea of hearing unto heeding, of listening unto obeying. Kaylee, go make your bed. Yeah, Dad. Wait a minute, your bed's that way. Did you hear what I said? Yeah. What'd I say? Make your bed. But wait a minute, your bed's that way. Did she hear what I said? Did she hear what I said? Okay. You make your bed whenever I ask you to make it. You're fine. Okay. But when we know as parents that we give an instruction to our kids, the kids can repeat to you the instructions. What did I say? Make your bed. Okay, go. Wait a minute. They know what we said. God says, listen, don't be like a kid who hears without hearing. I'm not just talking for my benefit, to make noise, to move sound waves. Okay, I'm talking because when I say something, something needs to happen. Remember who it is that we're dealing with. And God said, let there be light. And it was light. God said, let there be a firmament. Boom. There's a firmament. Let there be ground, earth. Boom. There's ground, earth. Make your bed. What? Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Don't hear without hearing. Hear unto obeying. Hear unto obedience. Conform your path to my instruction. Verse 22, obey his voice. Do all that I say. Do, the idea is accomplish, perform, execute. Bring into existence my very will. And he says, not selectively, but all that I say. Do it completely. Every time I talk, make sure that you conform your path to my will. Meyer points out that in verses 21, 22, 24, all the verbs are in the second person singular. You do this. The idea is that the collective action of the community requires the deliberate obedience of the individual. He's not just saying, y'all obey, okay? He's saying, you, Elsie Bosico, listen and obey. You, Matt Pulowski, listen and obey. And he's got your name. As he's got you by the collar and he's looking in your baby blues, he says, listen, this is instruction not just for Charlie, but it's for each one of us. It's also for Mark and for Jessica and for Mark. And this has our name on it. As we work through this, positively we're supposed to pay attention. Positively we're supposed to obey. Positively we're supposed to perform. Negatively, we're not supposed to rebel. The idea is rebellion speaks of an attitude that breaks relationship. You see how it says there in verse 21? Do not rebel. What are the next two words? Don't rebel against him. With regard to him, in relationship to him, don't rebel. Don't turn away. Don't have an attitude that breaks relationship. In effect, he's saying, don't work against the one that I've sent to work for you, to work on your behalf. Don't set yourself up in contradiction to him. Ryken says it's worth noting that the word used here for rebellion is generally used elsewhere in the Old Testament for opposition to the Almighty. Shaking my fist in the face of the one who's turned his face toward me. He says, don't do that. Don't rebel. Don't set your heart against me. Then he says, don't transgress. He will not pardon your transgression. Transgression speaks of action. If rebellion speaks of attitude, transgression speaks of action. I think sometimes as parents, we're better at correcting action than we are attitudes. I think sometimes as friends, as a church, we're better at dealing with actions than we are with attitudes. But actually, the one that God puts as a priority first, he says, listen, be careful of your attitudes because attitudes always lead to actions. Guard both. Guard both. He says, he will not blot out, he will not pardon your transgressions. The reason he says, be careful, the reason he says don't rebel, the reason he says don't transgress is this. He will not pardon. He will not lift your guilt. He will not clear your guilt. The idea is without the necessary cost. And his second point is this. My name is in this one that I've sent to you. My character's at stake. My justice is at stake. He can't just take your rebelliousness and your transgressions and pretend they didn't happen and set them aside. If it happens because of my justice, I need to deal with it. I have to deal with it to the degree that it needs to be dealt with. He can't just shove it under the rug as though it didn't happen. He's with you all the time. He sees everything you do. He hears everything you say. He's watching both your actions and your attitudes. Well, that's a little scary, except for the fact that he loves you. And he wants you to succeed. He really does. These are the reasons that God watches over our way. But secondly, verses 23 through 33, our loving Father intimately watches over our welfare. We move to verse 23, and we see that he's the source of our blessing. He says, when my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, Jebusites, and I blot them out, don't bow down to their gods or serve them or do as they do, but utterly overthrow them, break down their pillars, you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless you. The Lord our God is the source of our blessing. He says, I want you to understand, my child, my children, that what you have because of me. I'm the source of your blessing. That idea of blessing is the idea of the source or the context of life. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, he blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply. In Genesis chapter 9, after the flood, he gets Noah off the ark and he says, now be fruitful and multiply. When it comes to the blessing of Abraham's children, Abraham says, I don't have this promised son, but I have this Ishmael. God, will you take care of Ishmael? And God says, I will bless him, and he'll be fruitful, and he'll multiply. Jacob, in getting the blessing, in stealing the blessing, Isaac confirms it and says, be fruitful and multiply. Joseph goes down into Egypt, and it says, the blessing of God was upon him, and everything he did was fruitful and multiplying. God says, I want you to understand that I'm the source of your blessing. I'm the one who wants to make you fruitful and multiply. I will bless your water and your bread. It speaks to the source of our physical strength. The water and bread, nothing exorbitant about either one of them, but he's using them categorically. Everything you can eat, represented by bread. Everything you can drink, represented by water. All of the stuff that gives you physical strength and nourishment, I'm going to bless it. So that you don't just get physical strength from it, but so that you're spiritually renewed from the inside out. He says, I will take away sickness from you. And we see here that he makes a transition in the number of the pronouns. He will bless you. I will take sickness. What's happening is that change in the pronouns, he's beginning to unpack what this blessing looks like. I'll take sickness away from you. That is, God will actively usher away that which steals away your vitality and your life. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. He will not leave men without children. He will not allow them to be childless. He will not allow women to be childless. The idea is, I will give you a lasting blessing, a blessing that continues on with a heritage. I will bless you, and in blessing you, I will bless your children after you, and your grandchildren, and your grandchildren's children. A lasting blessing. I will fulfill the number of your days. Not just a lasting blessing, but a large blessing. This is in the PL stem. I will bring about a state of fullness in your days. I will sate you. I will like a sponge, I'll pour so much in that no more can be dumped into your life for all their days. In contrast to Psalm chapter 55, verse 23, where the wicked won't even live out half their days. And the days that they live out are anemic. Brueggemann says, the land itself will be saturated with God's good power for life and for living. God says, listen, this is my desire for you. I want you to succeed. I want to bless you. I want to pour life abundantly into you. You think of a New Testament verse that says that? Jesus says, John 10:10, behold, I have come that they might have life and that they might have it. Same thing, same God. Now, Ryken reminds us of this. These specific promises were for the Old Testament people of God. They're given at a time when God was using material blessings to teach spiritual truths. Therefore, we need to be careful not to apply these blessings and curses too literally. There are some who don't have children. We can't apply these specific promises too literally. Okay? Generally, he says, the principle still holds true. Obedience is God's pathway to blessing. But sometimes obedience, rather than leading to life, sometimes leads to death. As Jesus Christ comes, he says, it's my meat, it's my drink to do the will of my Father, to be obedient to my Father. And he ends up on a tree in obedience to his Father. We need to be careful as we read these Old Testament promises, we're not reading too much into them. But generally, the principle applies. The pathway to blessing is obedience to God. He's the source not only of our blessing, but of our success. In verses 27 through 28, he says, listen, I'm going to send terror before you. I'm going to throw into confusion. I'll make your enemies turn their backs on you. Verse 23, he says, I'll blot them out. I'll efface them. I'll rub them out. I'll extinguish their recognition and their memory. The idea of sending his terror, his dread or fright or horror. We come to Joshua chapter 2. We see Rahab says, "Our hearts were melting. We were dispirited before you." The idea of throwing into confusion is to stir up, to agitate, to disturb. The idea of setting in motion so as to cause a commotion. It's when you have young kids and you're sitting there in the quiet of the dawn and you're reading your Bible and you're drinking your cup of coffee and all of a sudden the first kid wakes up and you hold your breath. Something's set in motion and all of a sudden all the kids wake up and there's a commotion. God says, I'm gonna stir them all up and there's going to be such a confusion. Nobody's going to know what's happening. Except me. It's a part of my plan. I'm going to throw them in confusion. I'll make your enemies turn their backs to show their backs to you rather than their swords. I'll send the hornets. The idea is dense swarms of stinging insects that will put them out. It's interesting when you come to this section, there's three means of driving out. In verse 30, God says, "I will be the one who drives them out." In verse 28, he says, "The hornets will be the ones who drive them out." In verse 31, he says, "You will be the ones who drive them out." But that's only because God will be the one who turns them over into their hands. God says, it doesn't matter who is responsible for it, the hornets, you, or I do it by myself. I'm the one who gives you any measure of success in what I've called you to do. I'm also the one who gives you any measure of progress. In verses 29 and 30, he says, "I will not drive them out before you all in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply. But rather," verse 30, "little by little, I will drive them out before you." It's useful for us to remember where they're at in the story. Okay. They're really, really, really redeemed. They're really brought out of Egypt. They're on the other side of the Red Sea. They've walked through the waters. There's no going back. But they're not in the promised land. They're en route to the promised land. That is to say, they were saved. Their salvation is not complete. It was God who, in verse 23, brings them to the enemy. It's God, in verse 23, who blots out the enemy. But he says in verse 29, he won't drive them out completely all at once. Instead, he'll do so little by little. His purpose is so that the land doesn't become desolate. That is, so they don't become fruitless in the place of God's blessing. Listen, it's possible to give you too much too soon. I don't want to do that. And it's only for your sake. Okay, I haven't given Kaylee yet my keys to the Suburban. Not because I don't want Kaylee to drive the Suburban. Eventually, I would love for Kaylee to drive the Suburban. But not yet. Okay? Too much, too soon. In the second part, he says, lest the wild beasts multiply against you. That is, lest you fall not to your foes, but to your circumstances. Because you're not strong enough. You're not big enough. You're not capable yet to walk and chew gum at the same time. So we'll take away the gum so you can first learn to walk. We'll add the gum later. He says, this is what I want to do for you. Ryken says this, it's not always God's plan to give us an instant and total victory. Usually our spiritual progress comes just little by little. However, even this can be for our benefit. He wants us to learn how to depend on Him in ways that we never would unless we had to persevere through the gradual conquest of sin, knowing that God works little by little to help us to gain perspective on life. God helps us to win one victory little by little. He's the source of our progress. He's the source of our inheritance. Verse 31, I will set your border. Verse 33, they will not dwell in your land. Listen, folks. This is your land I'm giving to you. Yes, they're inhabitants of the land at present, but I will drive them out of your land. This belongs to you. It's your inheritance and it's from me. He's the source of our freedom, verses 32 and 33. Don't make covenant. Don't trap yourself. Don't bind yourself into an agreement that you'll regret with them or with their gods, that is socially or religiously. This new land is going to be a place of theological decision-making, and it's going to require rigorous decision-making. It's going to require emphatic decision-making. It's going to be cut and dried. I'm not going to because my allegiance is to God. I'm doing what I'm doing because this is who my God is, and this is what my God's said. Having been freed from their slave service to Pharaoh, he says, don't bind yourself to slave service to gods that don't bring life. They'll be a snare to you. They'll be like, you'll be like a squirrel in a trap who, while nibbling at the good stuff, gets its head snapped and its neck broken because it's caught in a snare that it can't get out of. I think it's an important reminder. It's easier for us to be influenced than it is for us to influence. He says, listen, cut off those things in your life that would suck you down, that would pull you down. Freedom from those gods that bind, freedom to serve the one true God who gives life. What is it? Back up in verse 25. You shall not serve them, but up in verse 25, you shall serve the Lord your God. He says, listen, when you get in the land, don't compromise. Break down, rout out, destroy, get rid of. You can't afford. Why? Because I'm such a terrible God? No. Because I love you so much. At the very end, Ryken says this, don't settle for a partial victory that falls short of full obedience. This is a loving father who's entreating his kids. Listen, I'm sending my servant, my messenger, to be with you. He's watching everything you do. In fact, he's watching what others do to you. But the purpose isn't to restrict you and confine you. The purpose is to lift you up and bless you and give you life. But make sure that you follow. Make sure that you heed. Make sure that you obey. As the Ten Commandments come to a close and he begins explaining them and drawing them into this covenant with them, he wants to impress them with the reality of this God. Having now explained things and worked things through and given them some rationale and given them some application, he changes the picture and he moves it to one not of fear but one of love. Because God's watchful presence is an intimate expression of his steadfast love. He's diligently looking for your obedience because he's desperately wanting your blessing. The Father up above is looking down in love on you. Isn't that an amazing thing? When you stop and think about it, in Psalm 139, down there in verse 18, how great are your thoughts? It's unfortunate that so many of the translations say, to me. It would be better translated, God's thoughts are toward me. He has me on his thoughts. That's the idea. God has me on his thoughts, and it's like the sand of the sea. Why? Because he's a king and he wants to be desperately followed and obeyed. Well, yes, but not just that. Because he's a God who loves his creatures, especially the ones that he's crafted to bear his own image, the ones that he's called to reflect his own nature. And he wants to move us into a relationship with him. You know, if you're here today and you've never had a fear of God, we don't know the same God because our God is greatly to be feared. There's consequences to running cross-grained to God's purposes. But if all you know of God is a fear of God, and you've never entered into that love of God, because you recognize that this God loves you. That's what salvation is. John says, we understand, we know, we've come to believe the love that God has for us. That's salvation, crossing over that threshold. If you're here today and you've never experienced a fear for God, I challenge you, go home and examine your salvation. On the flip side, if you're here today and you've never known the love of God, go home and examine your salvation. Because both are realities of a Father who longs to have a relationship with you so much that He sent His Son to buy your soul. That's a loving Father. Let's pray.